Well, hello everyone, and thanks for listening to the LID Radio podcast. I'm Morag, and today I'm joined by Adam Dixon to discuss his latest book, Australia, A Lighthouse in the Global Storm, The CEO Imperative. Adam is a senior partner at Kearney and chairman of its Australia and New Zealand business. His work spans strategy, organizational transformation, and the intersection of leadership and competitive advantage, themes that are brought to life in this book. Written in collaboration with Kearney's Australia partner team, Australia, A Lighthouse in the Global Storm is aimed at Australia's business leaders and addresses four transformational themes that will be key to the stability and growth of the Australian economy. In short, it's a manifesto that sets out crucial actions and directions for Australia's business leaders. Thank you so much for joining us on the LID Radio podcast, Adam. Just first question, why did you choose to write this book and why now?
I'm a naturalized Australian citizen, originally American. And one of the reasons why I immigrated here is because I think it's one of the greatest countries on the planet. However, I'm concerned. For the first time since I moved here originally 30 years ago, I'm worried the country is heading in the wrong direction. I see a morally confused and complacent landscape and deteriorating economic foundations. And I believe that free enterprise is part of the solution, not the problem. And this book is an unapologetic defense of free enterprise. And it's a call, a manifesto for CEOs.
So we'll get into some of those unique challenges and opportunities in Australia in a moment. But what was your process like in actually putting this book, this manifesto together?
Yeah, so we started very clearly focused on the CEOs, the chairs, and the leadership teams of Australia's most important institutions. And we knew that we wanted to write on transformational topics that cover a cross sector, but we also wanted to deep dive into some of Australia's most important sectors. And so with that in mind, we structured the book around five transformational topics and seven industry structures. And we started with provocative headlines and perspectives and a press release. And we tried to operate on a pull no punches principle because we wanted to say something that moved beyond just consulting jargon or banal points of view that may not offend anybody. Not that we're trying to offend anybody, but I think it's important that people are speaking more plainly. And I think it's important that people are speaking truth to power. And this was a collective effort. The partner team in Australia and many of our consultants all contributed. So I'd say there was about 30 or so of our team over the course of about 18 months wrote the chapters, and then multiple editing rounds. And then now here we are at publishing date.
This really does feel like a collective effort, like a collective bringing together of some brilliant minds then.
It certainly has. We had junior consultants who were doing deep research around specific topics because we wanted to bring some new and proprietary knowledge. Young consultants working with us. We had senior partners. We had people covering different sectors ranging from telecommunications to financial services. AUKUS is one of the chapters and its implications for the industrial base of Australia. So it really covered a whole bunch of different areas, which meant we needed a collective effort because there's no way I could cover all that knowledge on my own.
I'm sure you could get pretty close. So as you mentioned up top, you think there's a ripe moment to talk about Australia because it could be going in the wrong direction. You mentioned you were pulling no punches. You certainly didn't in that intro. What are some key points in the book that we can look forward to learning about?
Yeah, well, Australia is one of the wealthiest, healthiest, smartest, and safest nations on the planet. That's some of the reasons I decided to move here. Plus, it's a great rugby playing nation. However, Australia's hard-earned position is slipping. So labor productivity has slid to its lowest level in the 21st century. A cancel culture has overwhelmed corporate Australia. So CEOs today are five times more likely to get fired for non-financial reasons than they were 10 years ago. Talent and investment are increasingly looking to other markets where they can generate better returns. And so for all these reasons, among others, I see it's time to launch an unapologetic defense of free enterprise here in Australia.
Some of those things that you mentioned that labors down cancel culture in particular, we hear a great deal about how important it is. Probity, about how our CEOs have to be models of good behavior. You mentioned non-financial reasons. Why is it a bad thing that CEOs are being held to account?
CEOs being held to account is a good thing. The question is, when things go wrong, let's understand what actually went wrong and how significant is the crime, so to speak, and is the CEO involved and responsible for that crime? What we're seeing here in Australia is whenever there's an event with CEOs of the big corporates, there's a massive pile-on that we're seeing from the political space, from media, and so forth. And oftentimes, judgments are being made before the facts are really understood about what happened. I think it's really important that the boards get behind the situation and understand it and make a balanced and judicious assessment of what happened and who's responsible before jumping to eliminating a CEO.
Is this all encompassed in the chapter Leadership in a Time of Moral Confusion?
Yes.
I love that title, A Time of Moral Confusion. So it sounds like we're too trigger happy. We're not willing, we're Twitter analyzing, 140 characters or less. If you can't justify what you did in a brief soundbite, we don't have the capacity to dig into the detail to understand the nuance.
I think that's right. I think social media has played a very significant role. I think the attention span of the average reader has played a role. But I think the dynamic inside Australia is one where business leadership is oftentimes treated as a political football in the media and by politicians. And so it's an easy target for many to go after, and in some cases it's entirely justified. I'm not suggesting that CEOs should not be held to account, but the numbers have just become overwhelmingly stark in how much they've changed in a short space of time due to these other forces.
And so does this book propose a way of stemming the tide of making the moral confusion a little clearer?
Well, I think our primary target is the CEO and how CEOs can cope with the environment that we see ourselves within. And in this case, I believe that the primary duty of a CEO is to help his or her business create value. Businesses do fundamentally good things for the world, whether it's helping somebody to get a mortgage or whether it's helping to feed and clothe us or helping to connect us, whether it's with telecommunications or with logistics. These are fundamentally good goods and services that people value. And a CEO's role is to create value through the institutions that they're leading. And so I see a lot of leadership getting distracted by concerns and risks of pick your cause du jour. And our advice is, in Australia, surfing is a big deal. There's a saying in surfing that if you look at the rocks, that's what you're going to hit. And our point is, you got to be aware that the reef is there, but stay focused on the core purpose of the business and the customers. And that's the best way for CEOs to navigate through this difficult time.
So the CEO's role is vital. We get beyond the moral confusion part. And you mentioned earlier about declining productivity. Their role in supporting that productivity is vital.
There are structural issues which are leading to the long-term decline of productivity. And many of them fall outside of the remit of the CEO. Many of them are national. They have to do with political decisions, whether it's about the economy or industrial relations, taxes. Those kinds of structural decisions have been working against free enterprise for many years here in Australia. But inside the domain of the CEO, I do believe there's more that can be done for CEOs to improve productivity. And one of them is about having a really clear and compelling strategic narrative that is exciting to shareholders, exciting to employees, exciting to customers, that galvanizes the organization to be able to invest in its customer base with whether it's technology or networks or more capital asset intensive industries. So I think there's a role for the CEO to be the chief communicator of that strategic narrative. And I think it's important that productivity is a fundamental part of that narrative, where people feel inspired to come to work, where people feel inspired to give it the extra effort. And so that's where, creating a culture, creating a performance-based institution where people are willing to give it the extra effort to beat the competition or to innovate the next product or to serve that customer when there's a really complicated issue that comes up.
So we've talked about some of the challenges that Australia is facing, but this book is overwhelmingly positive. It's let's bring change. And in fact, you call it a lighthouse in a global storm. In what way is Australia a lighthouse in a global storm?
Yeah, well, so the storm is our environment. It's geopolitics, it's AI, it's wealth inequality, demographic challenges, moral confusion. I believe that Australia and Australian CEOs have the opportunity to help show others the way. And if we don't do it, if Australian CEOs don't do it, then who will?
If Australia's CEOs can take the lead, how do the rest of the world, ROW, take that inspiration? Because again, Australia, too many in the rest of the world, feels almost like a country apart. It physically, geographically is a country apart. How is the rest of the world going to take those learnings?
In the world of management consulting, one of the reasons we exist as a profession is to find best practices and ideas that exist in one industry or one part of the world and help to import them into another. So I think Australia, as much as anybody else in the rest of the world, can do exactly that. Australia can take decisions. It can role model how to run a business or how to innovate in ways that an American company, a Japanese company, a German company might look to it and say how extraordinary that is. There's many institutions in Australia that over the years have attracted the attention of others. I think about Telstra a few years ago under David Thodey's leadership when it doubled its market capitalization in the space of 5 years. And it, as a story, stood out among the whole global telco community. And there was enormous interest around the world in what Telstra was doing that was so extraordinary. I think the Rio Tintos and the BHPs, the CBAs, also Cochlear and Atlassian, there's lots of institutions that are based here in Australia and are able to capture the attention and the interest of other organizations.
There was an interesting chapter title here, which spoke to me given the recent war in Iran, something that in Europe, as I'm speaking from London right now, we wouldn't think impacts us that much, then suddenly Strait of Hormuz became a word on everyone's lips. There's one chapter that says rewiring Australia's supply chains for resilience. We've just seen how unresilient some of our supply chains are in the West. What does this mean in the Australian context?
Yeah, well, I should highlight that Kate Hart and Rajesh Shah are the prime authors on this chapter. I was a contributing author, so I want to give credit where credit's due. But over the past 25 years, the level of disruption of global supply chains has been increasing. It's becoming more frequent and more damaging when that supply chain is disrupted. So we actually wrote this before the war in the Middle East. And we had to think about whether or not we needed to rewrite it because we were already in publishing mode. But it actually stands up even because we had already mentioned straight up. What do you need to do? So Australia and institutions, not just here in Australia, but overseas, must better anticipate where the global pressure points are going to come from. And so here in Australia, the U.S.-China relationship, clean energy transition, pharmaceuticals, aging transport infrastructure, agricultural exports—those are some of the key issues for Australia. Some of those would be similar for other countries as well. But those are, in our views, five of the most important ones for Australia. And we envision a world where supply chains are both smarter and shorter. And this will require, inside the board and the leadership rooms, more strategic, more imaginative scenario planning, and it will require more investment in resilience. It's not just about supply chains at the lowest cost, it's about supply chains that you can rely on.
How is China impacting?
Well, China is a big export market for Australia and for Australian business, especially for its natural resources sector. And so it's a fundamental buyer of Australian goods. It's also a major supplier to Australia across many dimensions. In the case of any kind of a conflict that might emerge, Australian business will need to plan for and anticipate what that might mean for them, either for their own supply chain or for their customer and forward market.
Another chapter title that I deeply, deeply love. The Emperor is Wearing No Clothes. This is all about rolling back agile across corporate Australia. I thought agile was a good thing.
Yeah, that's what everybody thought. And that's what it sounds like, doesn't it? I mean, do things faster for lower cost and more innovative. Like what could be wrong with that? Look, this is perhaps one of the greatest own goals in corporate Australian history. Many of Australia's largest and most important institutions embraced agile at scale. And they took the idea based on Spotify, which was a 200-person software company, and envisioned it was the operating model of the future. It was religiously implemented, squads, tribes, guilds, and it confused the hell out of organizations with nonsensical consulting jargon. Costs went up and performance sank. Agile, small A, cross-functional teams working together to problem solve things and adapting to the environment, nothing wrong with that. But agile at scale was rolled out widely across organizations to places in the organization where it had no business. So in our view, agile needs to be put inside the parts of the organization that need it, and not done at scale. And what we've seen over the past several years is that most of the organizations have quietly mothballed their agile programs.
Are there any other trends, fads, agile-esque doctrines that you've seen that just make you think, oh, God, no?
Yeah, I think there was a lot of stakeholder capitalism where businesses started to try and satiate the appetites of many different stakeholders that just be, you know, it created too many competing demands. And ESG was one of the big trends. There's some good elements of ESG, but I think it was, again, as soon as something becomes ideological, it goes wrong. And that's what we've seen with some of these causes du jour, is that people move away from looking at the facts. They move away from looking at the numbers and embrace these things that they feel for reputational reasons or for whatever that they need to do. And so I think we try and stay focused on the stuff that is really structural. So like AI is interesting because it's big, maybe the biggest thing that happens in our lifetime. Certainly it will be among one of the biggest, if not the biggest, but there's a lot of hype about it too. So there's enormous amount of investment which has gone into it. And there's been very little returns that organizations have found. That's not to say that it won't come, and I do believe it will, but it's going to take time to figure out how to get value from this technological breakthrough.
In the book, particularly in the context of Australia, what are you seeing as positives versus negatives? Again, your chapter titles, I love them. Culture Eats AI for Breakfast. What are we talking about there?
Yeah. So let's talk about AI in two parts. First is our thesis around how do organizations get value from AI is to recognize that the technology in and of itself does not create value for an institution. It's being able to embrace the technology and change the way the business operates with the technology that creates value. And to make that happen, a company needs to change its operating model and its culture and its process. And it's in changing how work happens end-to-end inside an institution using AI where value is created. The second thing I'd say, or the other kind of angle, if we helicopter up from an Australian company and we think about AI in the most profound sense. And so we think about the world in scenarios. And so we looked at what are the most likely scenarios that play out over the next quarter century? And what are the primary driving forces of those scenarios? And there are two. One is geopolitics and one is AI. And so there's a world of a high degree of conflict or a world of low conflict, and a world of aligned AI where humans are in control, or potentially a world where AI is in control. And so if you think about those two dimensions and create the four scenarios that naturally fall out of that, the ideal world would be a stable world, aligned AI, or what we call the age of enablement. And so this is what abundance is about. This is what the tech bros all talk about, sometimes blindly. Another scenario is aligned AI and conflicted world. And that's like drone wars, where we're in control and at war and using drones. And we're seeing that play out as we speak. Another scenario, the third scenario, is where there's misaligned AI, but low conflict. And so this is where humans lose agency. And it's kind of like Brave New World 2.0. And then the fourth scenario, the worst case scenario, is where there's high conflict and misaligned AI. And this is like the Matrix trap. And Lord help us if we end up there.
This book covers such a broad range of wonderful, inspiring topics. And it is obviously reflective of all the great minds that have contributed to it. There is far more than we could possibly go into in a single podcast. There's information about playing to strength in retail, about redefining relevance in the CPG sector. Creating wealth and prosperity for all Australians clearly is something that is very important, close to your heart. If there's going to be a single most important takeaway from this book, what Australians and non-Australians can learn, What should we really be approaching this book and trying to take away?
Businesses create value. They help feed and clothe us. They give us energy to power us. They connect us. They finance us. And free enterprise is the engine not only for prosperity, but for progress. We're beset by multiple forces: geopolitics, AI, demographics, intergenerational division, moral confusion. Clear-headed leadership is needed now more than ever. CEOs need to speak up and lead. If CEOs don't do it, who will?
Well, if CEOs don't do it, who will? Perhaps those of us who read the book, Adam.
Well said, Morag. That's what I'm hoping.
So, Adam, what do you want our readers to feel about this book?
Well, I'm hoping it comes across as colorful, provocative, and interesting, and that people walk away with a sense of urgency to take action, and also a hopeful sense of agency, because it's our own agency which is the solution to the challenges that we face.
Having delved into it, I can say it is all of those things and more. Adam, thank you so much for joining us on the LID Radio podcast.
Thank you, Morag.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us on this LID Radio podcast. Make sure you keep an eye on our social media for LID Publishing on LinkedIn, X, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. See you next time on the LID Radio podcast.